welcome to the PureMed podcast special series Behind Diagnoses Patients. My name is Leah Sarapure, and I am your host. Behind Diagnoses Patients aims to uplift patient voices to share their insight and experiences navigating the healthcare system. It welcomes everyone from patient advocates, the chronically ill, the disabled, and those with rare diseases to offer suggestions for a more equitable world. On this episode, I'm pleased to welcome Caitlin Kerr, a disabled artist and advocate. She holds degrees in English literature, nursing, and nursing leadership. She had to leave the profession after her disabilities progressed several years ago. Caitlin lives with Ehlers-Danlos syndrome, rheumatoid arthritis, Crohn's disease, pudendal neuralgia, interstitial cystitis, adenomyosis, mast cell activation syndrome, and dysautonomia, among other disabilities. On her better days, Caitlin focuses on running a Shakespearean theater company with her partner, Jonathan. She's also a published poet as well as an actor and model. Caitlin serves on several committees and teams of organizations working towards more equitable healthcare and disability justice, such as the Outreach and Media Specialist for Faith Above My Ability, a nonprofit that educates, advocates, and creates change surrounding issues of access and equality for people with disabilities so that they can live their most empowered lives. The United Way's #IWantToWork campaign and the Pennsylvania Health Action Network. She also volunteers for PAAR, Pittsburgh Action Against Rape, as a sexual assault counselor and is a trained intimacy choreographer, director for theater, a role grounded in boundaries and consent. Much of her artistic work grows out of the reality of living with a rare chronic pain disorder and finding meaning in art and in connection with others. So Caitlin, today we are here for you. Please take it away in sharing your story in a way that communicates the good and the bad of our healthcare system. What inspired you to become a powerful patient advocate? And what do you think will push for a more equitable world?
Yes, Leah, that's such a complex question. And my story is such a complex and twisty turning journey. So I myself started out never really as a completely healthy kid. So I was born with hip dysplasia, dislocated hips, and a fractured femur. And from then on, I kind of accumulated weird things throughout my life that I always just dealt with humor. I thought, you know, I'm just going to joke about the fact that my kneecaps are dislocating, or I have to have my palate reconstructed in my mouth. And like all these things now should have probably been put together as part of a genetic disorder, and I would have been sent and evaluated and diagnosed with Ehlers-Danlos syndrome at an earlier age. So I'll get to that later. But what Ehlers-Danlos syndrome is a genetic connective tissue disorder that affects the production of collagen in the body, so that most specifically in the hypermobile type with joints, the ligaments and tendons are too stretchy to hold your joints in place. So your muscles are going to do some extra work trying to hold them in place. They don't always work. Sometimes you have dislocations. Often there are a lot of spinal issues that come with Ehlers-Danlos syndrome. I myself had a spinal fusion a little over a year ago, and some various other surgeries that have been caused by that. It can affect a lot of organs in the body as well. So as I was growing up, I just kind of dealt with some of these things by saying like, oh, it's really funny. Like my body's weird. I have bad luck. And I dealt with it with a lot of humor. When I was 13, I started experiencing really severe pain. And it, as someone who loved school, kept me out of school more than I would have liked at the time. And I wasn't really validated by most people in my life or by doctors in the pain, even though my mom was like really great about taking me to doctors and trying to find answers. And clearly among us were frustrated that we were coming up empty for answers. And so I just went and learned to deal with it in my life. And I went to school and I went to college. I'm from Western Pennsylvania and I went to Kentucky for school. So I got degrees in English with a theater minor because I love the arts. And that's another thing that I will get into later as a key part of my life. But I quickly realized that I really, really wanted to be in healthcare. And it was because of how I felt both the incredible impact of those rare providers who did make me feel seen, and also the incredible absence of providers who were dismissive or didn't care. And I decided to finish my English degree early and go into an accelerated nursing program. I did that in Kentucky, and I worked as a nurse there for several years, all the while, parallel to that story, accumulating more and more pain and more odd symptoms that were becoming increasingly debilitating. But I thought, surely I am a healthy person. I'm going to be able to work the rest of my adult life. Obviously, there's, you know, I'm fine. So I didn't know what was possible. I moved back to Pennsylvania to be with my family, and I got my master's in nursing and started working in management and oncology, which was my first true love in nursing. And I would go back to that in a heartbeat if I could. However, in 2016, went to Peru with my sister and got a parasite, as you do. I was the only one out of the group who got sick, came home, was put on really high dose of Cipro, which I didn't know that fluoroquinolone antibiotics then I knew that they have a risk of tendon rupture, but I was like, that's a really small risk. Like, that doesn't happen. Who it does happen to is people with connective tissue disorders. Ruptured a bunch of tendons in my left shoulder, doing almost nothing, just moving around in daily life. And from there on, it was kind of like an avalanche. So from there, it grew to back pain to where I couldn't get out of bed, and pain throughout my body, allergic reactions, just like everything started snowballing. So in the next year, in 2017, very early in the year, I realized I could no longer work. Again, was in denial about that, kept trying to go back to work, kept trying to return to my job, and eventually realized as I was laying on the floor in the break room, sobbing, that I couldn't do this anymore. Tried to work from home full-time as a nurse and couldn't do that either. I eventually won my disability case a few years ago, but that was a long and arduous road as well. Disability assistance, very hard to get. So I'll go into a little bit of the complexities of that in a minute. So basically, I went from someone who had a very high degree of independence and knowledge of healthcare to being completely helpless. And I knew already throughout my life that it wasn't easy to be believed and listened to. But quickly thereafter, I realized how painful that was to have the knowledge I did as a nurse and for it to be completely worthless. I could do nothing with it. And I maintain my license, but still now I am seen as the chronically ill patient when I go into the hospital for my many treatments, my many medications. And I remember now looking back on when I was a nurse and the reaction that healthcare providers at any level have to a patient who cannot work and or has chronic pain or symptoms that are not completely explainable. I myself am not even on opioid or narcotic pain medication. I don't absorb it. It doesn't work for me. But even if I were, that's my cat yelling. Yes, Stella, you know. But even if I were, that's no reason to disrespect me. Like, I will seriously go into the emergency room sometimes for an allergic reaction and be treated as though I'm there seeking pain medication or like seeking drugs, or like I'm treated as a faker almost all of the time. However, there are some great exceptions. I've gotten some wonderful doctors over the years and people on my team. But it's so hard for me to go into a hospital now, which used to be a place where I felt like I had a fair degree of power and influence and a fair degree of ability to change systems and create programs, which was what I was trained to do in my master's program. And now I go in and I am completely helpless. So going into real quick, the specific diagnoses I have. So I talked about Ehlers-Danlos syndrome a little bit. And that's Stella again, we love her. And it causes, in addition to the joint things that I described, a lot of pain, gastrointestinal issues can go along with it, dysfunction of the autonomic nervous system, leading to, in a lot of people, fluctuating heart rate, inability to regulate temperature, blood pressure, that sort of thing, and increased risk of issues with other body systems like your joints, your spine, your brain, your pelvis, your genitourinary system. And I also have rheumatoid arthritis, Crohn's disease, mast cell activation syndrome, which is sort of like that allergic reaction stuff I was talking about before, but it is not a typical allergic reaction with those immunoglobulins. It is caused by the mast cells, which are essentially they cause allergic reactions by releasing mediator proteins stored inside them or made by them. And every patient is different. It can affect your skin, your respiratory system, and even more than that. And then also I have interstitial cystitis, which is sometimes called painful bladder syndrome, which it's a lot more than that. It's screaming on the floor, praying for death syndrome. I joke, but I also don't, because that's really my reality a lot of the time. I'm on a lot of medications, but it's still incredibly difficult to deal with a high degree of unpredictable and severe bladder pain and dysfunction. I also am, over time, unable to fully void my bladder on my own and often have to catheterize myself. So there are some other things I deal with, but that is beside the point. Kind of just wanted to emphasize that there are a lot of things that I, dealt with growing up that only amplified over time and truly can not only happen to people in that manner, but can happen to people in an instant. Anyone can become chronically ill or disabled due to either a genetic issue, due to an accident, due to an illness. It can happen to anyone so quickly. And, even though I grew up with these mild but weird issues, and I would have possibly been diagnosed had I been a child now, but that's not necessarily true. There's not always a lot of awareness about the disorder. And I attempted in various ways to keep working, but I eventually could not do that. So when I got Social Security disability and the Medicare that comes with it, I initially thought that this would be my saving grace when it came to medical costs. Because on marketplace plans in the US, I was paying upwards of $1,000 out of pocket after insurance for my meds per month. And I thought that was a lot. When I got, and that doesn't include other medical costs or the cost of my plan. So when the monthly premiums were lower, of course, but in 2020, I spent out of pocket after insurance on Medicare $25,000. In medical expenses. And to some people, that wouldn't even be a lot. And I was like, I'm on Medicare. This is not how it's supposed to work. This is supposed to save me money. But I have a lot of very expensive medications. And I wasn't even taking all of the ones my doctors wanted me to take. I remember one time receiving a phone call about one of my drugs for my RA. being told, hey, you know, on this plan, after insurance, it's going to be $4,300, like nonchalantly per month, in addition to my other medical costs. And I just started laughing maniacally. I was like, you've got, like, you know, this is like, you're not saying this with a straight face, are you? Like, I know it's not your fault, but like, the words coming out of your mouth are very funny. No one has that much money. So essentially what I was doing, where did that $25,000 come from? It came from my retirement account, because of course I wasn't making that much money. Since I, you know, was 15 up until age 30, I was, you know, pretty good at saving. I tried to, you know, do the typical thing, saving my money and putting a lot of money away into retirement. And so that's what I was draining that account day by day, just draining it. And I was like, what do I need to do? Of course, you know, I needed Medicaid. And in order to qualify for Medicaid, you have to be fairly income and asset poor. For traditional Medicaid, you have to have fewer than $2,000 in savings and assets as an individual person, $3,000 as a couple. And you have to make almost nothing now. I have SSDI and I was working a couple hours a week, just a couple from home, and for some extra money. So I, a lot of states, including Pennsylvania, have Medicaid buy-in programs for people with disabilities who are working even a small amount. So it basically just has to be minimum wage, but the cutoff is 250% of the federal poverty level in most states, like it is in Pennsylvania, as far as income. Now, when we're talking about assets, a lot of those programs also, like traditional Medicaid, have an asset limit. The asset limit in Pennsylvania is $10,000. I thought, great. So I applied and they said, no, you have more money than that. And I'm like, but it's in my retirement account. Nope, retirement also counts as an asset. And more than one car, if you are a married couple, will count as an asset. It gets very specific down to jewelry of value. You are permitted to have one engagement and one wedding ring. Like it gets very, you're allowed to have a $1,500 in prepaid burial expenses. Like it gets very disgustingly patronizing and paternalistic in how it regulates people. So upon doing research and speaking with lawyers, I had to divest myself. So I emptied my retirement account and put it in what is called a special needs trust. That trust is out of the stream of my income and it cannot be used on food or shelter. It is also not my money. I have to ask for it, and I have to ask for it for very specific things. And it is also not going to anyone on the event of my death. I get hit by a car tomorrow, it does not go to anyone in my family, doesn't go to my partner, doesn't go to anybody, it goes to the trust. Now, there are things called ABLE accounts for people who are deemed disabled by the government before age 26, but that was not me. I wouldn't have known that. I didn't know any of these things, and most people don't. Most people who work for the government on a state or federal level don't. Most people who work with disability as their job in the government do not know about these programs. So the program I specifically applied to and now have was MAWD, M-A-W-D, Medical Assistance for Workers with Disabilities. So I do actually work a small part-time job from home, like I said. Many days I can hardly do that, but if I didn't, I wouldn't be able to afford my daily living expenses and medical expenses, even with my SSDI or Social Security Disability insurance payments, Medicare and Medicaid. So I have all of those things. Now, when you have Medicare and Medicaid in the States, you are what is called dual eligible for a program called Extra Help or LIS, low income subsidy for prescription drugs. That is what allows me to afford my medications. I take about 32, so I think it's either 33 or 34 now, medications per day. About five or six of them are astronomically expensive and make up the bulk of expense. So for covered drugs, I do get assistance now. Several of my medications are still not covered. So I'm still paying a few hundred a month for meds, but for me, that's a huge change from shelling out thousands per month in medical expenses. So essentially for me, these experiences highlighted two main looming injustices about our country and the States. And also it's very similar in other countries. It's very similar in Canada. It's quite similar in the UK right now, I believe, but you know, there are some mild differences. So two looming injustices about medical assistance programs. One is forced poverty. Okay, so as of 2017, over 26% of working age people with disabilities lived in poverty. That is more than twice the rate of their non-disabled peers. And an astonishing 60.5% of households that included a disabled person were considered asset poor, meaning that they didn't have enough resources to live at the federal poverty level for 3 months. Half of all working age adults who experience at least 1 year of poverty have a disability, and nearly two-thirds of those experiencing long-term poverty have a disability. The other and concurrent intermingling injustice was marriage inequality. So I reached a point where I realized if I were to marry or even look like I was married to my partner, I would lose my Medicaid because I would be over the income limit and over the asset limit if we decided to accumulate assets in the future, or we're able to, or we're lucky enough to. The current asset limit for the program I was on, again, the Medicaid buy-in program in Pennsylvania, was 250% of the federal poverty level for your monthly income. What I ended up doing is researching this to death because this is ridiculous. There are some states that do not count spousal income or assets. There are some states that don't count spousal assets. There are some states that don't count both. It's very complex, almost intentionally so, one might think. So how it works is that, you know, it's not because marriage for disabled people is forbidden by law, as same-sex marriage was until 2015 here, but because of the very real risk we face of losing government assistance that's necessary to our survival in so many cases and in mine. And healthcare is very expensive for some disabled people, especially those that need home care, home and community-based services, medical devices, lots of medications or procedures, and the cost can never be made up for by a disabled person added to a spouse's plan. And there is no spouse's plan that includes the home and community-based services that many of my friends need to get ready for work every day, especially those who are wheelchair users. So all of this results in many disabled people having to stay single, and often having to do everything they can to avoid being seen as married, and that everything they can is taken from a piece of legal advice from a lawyer in New York. Some people risk it. Some people try to do a ceremony and, you know, put pictures up and say, oh, it's just a piece of paper. So two things to say to that. One is, it's not without risk. I've seen people do it and get away with it. I've also seen people do it and lose everything because they are allowed, the government is allowed to go through your mail, interview your friends and family, ask them how you introduce yourself. Husband and wife, couple, do you use the last name in any setting? Have you ever? Are there pictures out there of a ceremony saying you are husband and wife? It's incredibly invasive and it's incredibly repulsive. The other thing I have to say about that is there's, you know, doing just a ceremony and saying it's, oh, it's, you know, because it's just a piece of paper. Yeah, sure. I think we should question systems. We should question what marriage really means. We should interrogate those for ourselves, but as a thought exercise, not on a large level with real consequences. Marriage is not just a piece of paper. It has real, powerful social and legal benefits that are granted to people who are married and who do have a spouse. That is very different. You do not get those social and legal and financial benefits if you are not legally married. So mentioned holding out, and that is what it's called. Holding out is basically the government saying you're faking being married to try to trick us and get away with something. Although it's really silly because it doesn't really save them money at all. Because if any disabled person knows about this, they respond to these penalties simply by not marrying. So what does the government save? The only time the government, quote unquote, saves money in this situation is from people who did not know about these penalties and acted anyway. So really there's no reason to do this other than a long history of eugenics and preventing disabled people from getting married. It's confusing on purpose, I think, honestly. And the inconsistency in marriage penalties also causes confusion for both abled and disabled people, since all of our situations are so different. Marriage penalties affect someone who receives SSDI on their parents' work record versus someone who receives it on their own work record in different ways. For example, if I was just on SSDI on my own work record, getting married wouldn't affect me at all. If I was receiving it on my parents' work record, I would lose that SSDI. And then there's SSI, which sometimes also, like, I don't have SSI, but I have Medicaid. A lot of time the two of them go together. So for Medicaid, that is something that marriage will cause you to lose if you go above the income and asset limits. And the range of effects also varies. For some cases, marriage can result in a lower monthly check if someone receives the SSI monetary payments. In other cases, it can trigger loss of healthcare benefits or loss of insurance, which for many of us is far more damaging than loss of monthly income. Healthcare is not a just-in-case insurance policy for disabled people. It's necessary to live. So yes, this all goes back to when the government created policies that advocated for example, forced sterilization as the quote-unquote cure for disabilities. During the eugenics movement in the first half of the 20th century, tens of thousands of people with disabilities were forcibly sterilized or segregated, often in institutions, and they were also prohibited from marrying by law in many states. And even though they are less overt, these type of eugenics practices continue in principle today, and many of those old laws actually have never been officially repealed. So these outdated financial measures and strict regulations affect how much people can earn, how much is available in assets to them. These asset limits for most states have not been raised since 1984. Income and limits and asset caps for SSI and SSDI are very strict, as I have just referenced. And it's absurd to comprehend this, you know, like, and to explain it to people, and people, you know, surely that's not a thing. Oh, it is. So yeah. So when I was responding to all these things, taking them in as things that affected my own life, I had met my partner, who's the love of my life. And originally just thought I wasn't going to get married, and then we realized together that was something we really wanted. And really quickly realized after that we couldn't have that. So, okay, how do you deal with that? On a large scale level, on a national level, that's going to take a lot of manpower. So we're going to start at the state level. And this is how my brain is going through these things at the time. The MOD program, or the Medicaid buy-in program for people who are working, who have a disability in my state. I was like, okay, so let's look at if there's any legislation going on to try to change that. There was some that had been in the works for a few years, but hadn't passed through many committees or gotten very far. And I was very committed to attacking that aggressively. So what MAUD was in Pennsylvania was, what I said, a Medicaid buy-in program, and the with very strict income and asset limits. As I had said before, the asset limits were $10,000 for that program, and the income limit was 250% of the federal poverty level. That's super, super low. But what we wanted to do was change that so that they could earn more. Essentially, what 250% at the federal poverty level is around, after some deductions and some math, $2,600 and change in American dollars, so per month. And that includes money in the bank, stocks, savings account, retirement plans. In Pennsylvania, you know, only 35% of people with disabilities are working. Only 21% work full-time. It seems unnecessarily cruel that medical assistance is at risk if an individual works too much, when medical assistance is often the very thing that allows them to work in the first place. One of my good friends, Jessica, she runs a nonprofit called Faith Above My Ability. And she became a very fast friend of mine as she was explaining to me how she was going to have to shortly resign from her job teaching as a special education teacher because she would make too much money and would then be kicked off the programs that allowed her to get ready in the morning to go to work and do some of her very basic self-care activities of daily living. I had another friend that was going through the divorce process from her husband so that she could keep her medical insurance. And so when it became not just me, but an accumulation of people that I knew who were being very immediately and severely affected by this, it lit a incredible fire in me to connect with other advocates. There were other advocates I connected with at the United Way's hashtag I Want to Work campaign, including Dr. Josie Padger, and hooking up with all these people and creating solidarity, as well as just completely going all in on this, was something that I gave and sacrificed a lot of energy for. A lot of times for me, you know, with my current disabilities, getting up and getting ready in the morning is really hard. But when you tell me my friends' lives are at stake, I'm going to crawl there on my hands and knees across the country if that's what it takes to help them. So it really did, you know, that's not sustainable to live and do that all the time, but I did it as much as I could for as long as I could. Those types of things included calling, emailing, writing letters and pamphlets to the state senators and reps. It included writing letters to the editor, going on as many podcasts as I could, putting out as much social media, infographics, interviews, TikToks, whatever I could think of to try to raise awareness and get people to act on that. So just sign a lot of times, you know, I love a good online petition, but that's not what's going to change the mind of a lawmaker. What's going to change the mind of a lawmaker who has a bazillion things to think about every day is honestly in person, speaking with them and explaining in very digestible pieces of information, because they have a lot to deal with, what this is, why you want it, what action needs to be taken, how it will fix things, and stories. You know, I was often told when I first started out working, you know, what changes the mind of people in power is numbers and data. And that seems logical. But we don't operate on logic as human beings all the time. We operate at what changes our minds and our hearts and gets us to act with passion. Are stories, and true stories, powerful stories, stories like those of my friends who have to give up their dream job teaching students and providing them a person who looks like them in front of the classroom. Stories about people who are divorcing the person they've been married to for 30 years so they can get a medication they need to stay alive. Stories of people like me who've met the love of their life and their soulmate at age 30, you know, after not believing in those things and wanting desperately to get married to that person and knowing that now I have to scrub my social media of any reference that we were ever romantic partners and tell the hospital and my advanced directive that he is my roommate. So what kind of change was needed? So there were parallel bills in the State House and Senate in Pennsylvania. Senate Bill 156 was introduced and sponsored by Senator Bob Mensch of the 24th District. It was proposed allowing individuals with disabilities to increase earnings under a new category of that MOD, that Medicaid buy-in program in Pennsylvania. It was called Workers at Job Success. That would allow workers to earn up to 600% of the federal poverty level without losing their MOD and Medicaid that comes with it. Anything earned above the 250% cap would move them into that category. And they would, instead of paying 5% of their income as monthly income as a premium for that health insurance plan, that Medicaid, it would be 7.5%. And then even above that, even earning above that, it would just be 100% of the average for MOD. So that was the goal. So it was a bipartisan bill. It was surprisingly, and I believe strategically, sponsored by Republicans in both the House and Senate. However, it was treated as a Democratic bill, and I kid you not, because it helps people. I want to laugh, but it's the honest truth. It was met with a lot of, and to be clear, I myself identify with neither party, but my views are much more extreme than that. But that's my views. How I act in politics on a daily basis is nobody's business. Although I'm willing to share my own views at another time. So this was treated as a bill that was opposed by Republicans, even though it was sponsored by Republicans. The goal of this legislation was to incrementally remove income limits and allow workers with disabilities to increase their earnings without repercussions. More people work, more people paying taxes. You know, like, what is the downside of this? Absolutely none. There were lots of Pennsylvania state legislators who assisted with this bill. And, you know, I could name them for days. There were people who we got on our side that were wonderful and helpful people. We also met a lot of resistance. So the last week of the session this year, after I had personally been working a little over a year on this, we were basically told from our lobbyist and from inside information that, you know, hey, up and down, okay, the bill's gonna go through, okay, it's not, okay, it is, okay, it's not. We had gotten it through the whole House, it was in the Senate, and there's so much that goes on behind the scenes that you know, causes the bill to go through. But so much had been done, and we were meeting absolutely closed doors at every turn. My friend Jessica, who I previously mentioned, and I went to Harrisburg on a whim. I had my mom and partner drive me. I laid in the back seat. I was in the middle of a really big pain flare. And the night before, Jessica was like, I'm going to go. I'm just going to go to Harrisburg. She lived a couple hours away. I live 4.5-5 hours away. And that's the state capital in Pennsylvania. So I was in the middle of a big pain flare, and I was like, you know what? If the rules were reversed, I would really, really want someone to do this for me. So, you know, that wasn't a huge thing, but I was like, I'm getting my butt there. I'm getting through the day. It's one day in my life. It's gonna hurt. It's gonna be rough, but it's one day in my life, and I need to get myself there. And Jessica even went back 2 days later. We made, you know, pamphlets. We talked to countless people. We called news teams. We tried to be as visible as possible. And eventually, after many, many ups and downs, the bill, Senate Bill 156, now Act 69, was signed by the governor. And it goes into effect on December 29th of this year, 2021. And the other requirement that I didn't mention before to get into that new category, Workers with Job Success, is also that you've been on the program for a year. So that is another criteria that had to happen. But so that's a really good thing. So now it needs to happen in some other states. Ideally, no, on a federal level for Medicaid, spouses' income and assets shouldn't be considered, I don't believe. However, in states where they are, they should be considered for both. So you can't just say, oh, I'm going to count spousal assets against you, but not income, so that you can't get into this category, but you still have to stay asset poor. Now, we got to be consistent with this, but that's a whole other thing. So what has been achieved? Really, this is just so much study has been done by the DHS and PA legislators. The DHS is the Department of Human Services, to examine the cost of adjusting this program. 11 other states already have adopted similar policies and found them to be beneficial or cost neutral or even cost less. And really, moral of the story, disability equality benefits everyone, not only through a financial lens, but analyzed with the reality in mind that 1 in 4 Americans has a disability. And as we age, we are increasingly likely to need assistance. I like to say that disability is always recruiting. And if this assistance comes at the price of losing financial independence or even one's spouse to keep that assistance, then the assistance itself is unjust. So that's how we got to where we are now, and we have a long way to go.
Wow, Caitlin, I have no words to tell you how appreciative I am to hear that story and how inspiring it is to see the work, incredible work that has been gone into this. And I applaud you for all that it took, for the day ins and day outs and all the difficult days and the emotional days. But you've accomplished something that is going to be changing the lives of so many in Pennsylvania and across the country, eventually and hopefully very soon. So my advice to you is please just keep going. You are powerful, your story is powerful, and very much is very needed in to change and move change in the system. So I'm just taken away with your story, Caitlin.
But thank you for letting me share, and thank you for letting me be chatty.
No, I loved it. But now I have a few questions for you, so feel free to answer them in any way you like.
Okay.
The first question I have for you, Caitlin, is what matters to you when interacting with health professionals or undergoing invasive examinations?
Yes, so I think what matters the most to me is transparency about what they know or don't know, and just humanity, honestly. When someone can look me in the eye and see me as a person, that is communicated non-verbally. It's very easy to tell if you're in the hands of a person who cares or not. And I think also, you know, I know health providers have so much to do, but going above and beyond is not possible in every single interaction or for every single aspect of care. But sometimes it's just that one little thing that makes me feel like a provider has my back. So for example, my nurse specifically, you know, coming in and asking if they can bring me an ice pack for no good reason. You know, it's like, they don't have to do that, but they should. And that's a very basic thing. Or a provider even themselves calling me in between patients and saying, you know, hey, I'm in between patients right now, but I want to let you know I saw your labs. We're going to follow up about those later. Or, you know, communicating with me saying like, hey, I don't know about this. I really want to do some research on it. I'd like to make this happen for you. Or just open communication sometimes it's truly just that one little thing. And believing me, you know, being disbelieved is so hard. I put off seeking help for so many years because of what is essentially internalized ableism, and mostly because of knowing how patients with symptoms like mine, many, and doctor visits like mine, also many, are treated. And I was a part of that. You know, they're treated poorly, put it mildly. Every time I visit an emergency room, again, I'm assumed to be there for purposes that are not what I'm saying, you know. Mm-hmm. In my experience, was Maya Dusenberry, who writes about disabilities, wrote that it is hard work being a credible patient. That's very true. So being taken at face value and treated as credible is so valuable. Like that's really, it goes a long way.
And my second question for you, Caitlin, is how can patients ensure that they feel respected, heard, and understood, and that they receive and have their healthcare priorities respected?
I think it's hard. It's hard when you're, especially when you're on your own, or when you're a member of a marginalized group of any kind. That makes it even harder to ensure that you're receiving care and being taken care of when you don't have access to resources. But I would encourage you to reach out. Many states have a legal help program for disability and for medical needs. Or wherever you live, I would Google free legal help in your area and try to reach out for help if you can. Having an advocate with you at appointments, if it's your friend, if it's a family member, if it's a partner, can be incredibly helpful. And to realize that you're not a burden. You're not. Please try not to feel bad, even though I do it too. You know, we're not machines. Relationships are not transactional, even though they're treated like that in our society. My family and friends often feel as helpless as I do and want to make things better. Asking for help allows them to do that something for you. And then also to realize that even if you're not working in a job, you are worthy. Often the first question I get asked when I meet someone new is, what do you do? And I don't always look disabled, especially if I'm not using a mobility aid that day. And I'm like, well, that's a complicated question. But to realize inherently that your worth is not based on your work. If you can't walk or stand, it's hard to have a mainstream career, but you're valuable. You deserve rights. You deserve happiness. If you spend most of your days in too much pain to speak, you're not going to be reliable enough to work enough to earn a gainful wage, but you deserve love. You're a beautiful human being just by being.
You said it wonderfully, Caitlin, that those are such important values, and we often forget them when we're in the middle of a healthcare appointment or even just going home. And I think what you've said is extremely important for patients to understand. But although this is a loaded question now, and there's a lot of things that need to be improved in the healthcare system, in your perspective, what is at least one thing that can be done to improve our healthcare systems?
Yeah, that is a loaded question. I could come at it from a number of different perspectives. That's my cat yelling again. She feels very passionately about this. Of course, on a governmental level, changing where the money comes from and where it goes, making healthcare accessible to all and making the access to that healthcare not have to be in exchange for your basic human rights, like being able to get married or save money. Or, you know, I have to also, you know, I have to be careful and limit how much I do work, even when I can, for fear of losing even my Social Security disability insurance, even with the changes to Medicaid. It's very complicated. So Medicare, Medicaid, all of these programs, very complicated. But what needs to change is both on a governmental level and both on the way that providers and the, you know, higher ups, the CEOs of health conglomerates and corporations view human beings, and putting money ahead of patients needs to stop. And that's, of course, needs to come from a legal perspective, from a legislative perspective. Those are the changes that need to be made. But as individual providers within the system, to check your own ableism, and we all have it. I had we all have it. And even when I was a nurse with disabilities, being able to work, I didn't interrogate the way I viewed patients who I didn't understand. You know, there are many different populations now that are, of course, more susceptible to COVID. And in this time, viewing disabled people essentially as disposable is what is being played out in the conversation around basically reopening the country of businesses, being put ahead of those who are just wanting to live and stay alive, is very complex. There's less hospital space, shortage of ventilators. So those in charge of hospital care need to come at this from a very human perspective and have that fire lit under them to not just lay back and say, oh, I can't do anything about this. You can try. At the very least, you can try, and you can advocate, and you can be a loud voice. You can be a louder voice than your patient can. And I think, you know, the conversation around that is, or at least the situation right now we're seeing play out across the world with COVID, is highlighting the great disparity in power between patients and providers. And providers, of course, are also suffering under this system, and they need to be taken care of. So, of course, again, this all goes back to money. But I believe that states and individual hospitals, basically, I've seen and heard from my friends that they, you know, have developed or revealed policies that revolve around scarcity, either explicitly or implicitly, and excluding people with disabilities, not just on an individual basis, but in some cases, categorically, by diagnosis and certain arbitrary measures that have little to do with COVID-19 survivability, but rather with subjective and perceived, quote unquote, quality of life. Our lives are worth fighting for. They are worth living. They'd be a lot easier if we weren't in either constant pain or constant fighting for our life, either against the system or against symptoms or against or for medications, for insurance. Anything providers can do to ease that constant fight, either on an insurance level or on a symptoms level, alleviates a little bit of our burden so that we can do some of the more human things that make us feel alive. For me, you know, that's the arts, that's poetry, theater. I don't act as much now due to my physical abilities, but directing, you know, what are those human things that I will get to do a little bit more of if a provider realizes that even if I'm not working, even if I'm in pain, I have a quality of life that I aspire to, and that makes my days worth going through. So seeing patients through that lens is the first step, and then also realizing the severity of what not fighting for change for those patients truly means. It means life or death. It means literal life or death. And it means our basic human rights in terms of relationships and the basic things we do that make us human.
That was so beautifully put, Caitlin. Thank you so much for putting in a whole what needs to be changed, because you incorporated so many aspects of change that need to be upheld in the system. And so my last question for you is, if there is anything or anyone that is trying to fight the system or put for change, or even a patient just wanting to share a story and they're too afraid, what would you say to them?
Yeah, I would say, first of all, your fear is valid. Sometimes when you are afraid to share your story, it is because of the very real consequences that may happen if you share your story, whether that's employment related, or for me personally, I, for a long time, did not share about marriage equality because I was afraid they're going to come for me. You know, they were going to see me speaking out loud about myself and my partner, and we would be forced to live separately for potentially forever. But then I just got so angry that I realized, hey, if this is what I have to sacrifice in the short term for this to be changed in the long term, I'm going to go down, I'm going to go down swinging. But yes, first of all, your fear is valid. And then also reach out. Don't be scared. There's a great online community, whether you're on Instagram or Facebook, Twitter. Reach out to other disabled creators or advocates, or even just people who are speaking about their disabilities. They might not all get back to you, and don't take it personally, because they may be going through a health crisis, just like you may be sometimes. But reach out, build connections, build solidarity, find people who are like you, and then also look at legislation that's going on and how you might be able to advocate for it. For example, in the states right now, on a national level, there are several bills for the SSI Restoration Act in the upcoming recovery legislation. And on its own, the SSI Restoration Act really has no chance of coming up for a vote. But in the long term, we need to look at these things. Yes, sign petitions, that's all great. But in scripts for calling your representatives are all great. But what can you do to think outside the box? Because legislators receive so many petitions and scripted messages daily. Those, I'm not saying don't do those, that's valuable, but what can you do that's potentially different than something they've seen? Can you send them a video of you speaking candidly, showing images from your life? Can you go in person perhaps and request a sit down conversation with them? Can you create some sort of, whether it's a graphic, whether it's a art piece, like visual art, poetry, something that is meaningful to you, share it with them and why that means, what needs to change. And that's very humanizing, first of all, and it's also impossible for them to look away from. That sticks with people. Stories stick with people. Telling either your story or someone else's, if it's not safe to tell your own story. I totally respect the safety of people to not always, hi Stella, tell their own story, but that can be very powerful. So coming up with something different and creative to try to advocate for change. So interacting with lawmakers, that's one thing. And then also, can you put something out there in the world? And maybe it'll only reach one or two people. And I say only, not meaning that as a diminutive thing, but one or two people, maybe those people go on to talk to a couple other people about this issue. It's, for example, I was having a surgical procedure a few months ago, early this year, and another fun feature of Ehlers-Danlos syndrome is it takes a little more anesthesia for some of us to knock us out. So, of course, I'm given a believer said, and I'm, asked by the anesthesiologist who I had warned, you feeling sleepy now? I'm like, I'm literally feel no different than 20 minutes ago. So the fun opportunity there was as I was wheeled into the OR, I was like, hey guys, do you want to hear about something? And I talked to them about all 10 people or whoever, however many people were in that OR, about what was going on currently before the bills in my state had passed and what that would mean to me. And, anesthesiologist was like, okay, we're gonna crank up the percent now. You're gonna go to sleep. But I had a good 5 minutes in. So sometimes just talking to the people that you meet, you don't have to do it all the time. That's exhausting. Care for yourself. I guess that would be my final advice. Care for yourself. You can't be a machine and advocate all the time. Reach out for those who love you, and reach out and be there with them and let them be there for you.
Okay, well, thank you so much. I don't know how to thank you enough, but I just want to thank you for coming onto the PureMed podcast, for sharing your story, for being so vulnerable, for going into this much detail, and for being an advocate for change. With the special series Behind Diagnoses Patients, we hope that it sheds light on the importance of listening to patients such as yourself. Your voice is powerful, and that over time, it will ensure healthcare safety, health innovation, and transform care delivery within the clinic and beyond. So thank you wholeheartedly from the entire team for coming on and for sharing your story that is making a difference and saving lives.
Thank you so much, Ilya.
I'd like to thank our sponsors, Hashtag Rising Youth, the Government of Canada, Canada Service Corps, and Taking It Global for supporting and funding the project. I'd also like to thank the incredible individuals, voices, and patients who appear on the series, and whose stories will guide medical education, clinical practice, and healthcare innovation. Listen in and listen now to the Behind Diagnoses Patient Special Series on the PureMed podcast to ensure change for a better world. Catch us on the next episode in conversation with another incredible patient advocate. And if you need more information, do not hesitate to email us at puremedfoundation@gmail.com. Thank you for tuning in. Stay safe, stay healthy.